We know that pledge breaks are your least favorite part of listening to NHPR. So we've been trying really hard to eliminate them this month. If we manage it, if you help us manage it, we can eliminate those pledge breaks this month. But we need your help now to make it happen. More of your favorite programs, fewer interruptions when you make a gift now at nhpr.org. This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A new documentary called Shadows Fall North reveals what it calls the invisible history of African Americans in New Hampshire. Little-known stories like the multiracial boarding school established in the 1830s that was destroyed by residents of a northern New Hampshire town. Or the elegantly dressed black couple who, in the 1960s, desegregated the upper crust crowd at a grand hotel. Longtime black history activist Valerie Cunningham says these tales and many others have too long been easily ignored.
You see references in newspapers and magazines still about how lily white New Hampshire is. New Hampshire has never been lily white, and it is not now.
Cunningham and others in the film say a fuller retelling of New Hampshire's black history also complicates our state's self-image as an abolitionist stronghold and challenges our conviction that we never treated African Americans as poorly as they did down south. Today in The Exchange, Shadows Fall North, the new film that shines a light on New Hampshire black history. Let's get you into our conversation. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Jerrianne Bogus, director of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail, founder and director of the Harriet Wilson Project. She also was deeply involved in this film. And Jerrianne, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, someone else who was involved with the film, David Waters, state senator, English professor at UNH, and a longtime New England historian. And David Waters, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Oh, good morning, Laura.
And with us on the line is Nancy Vodder, film producer for Shadows Fall North. The film is a collaboration, by the way, between the UNH Center for the Humanities and Atlantic Media Productions. And Nancy, good to have you. Thank you also for being with us.
Laura, for having me.
Well, Jerrianne, I want to start with you, but hear from everybody. What's the big key idea that you hope this film adds to how people understand New Hampshire overall?
Well, I think what the film does is create another tool, a visible tool of this history. We have the Burying Ground now, Memorial now up in Portsmouth. We have the Harriet Wilson statue in Milford. And so this adds to that visibility of the history. And what it does, it creates a space for us to reimagine, revisit what the history, what New Hampshire's history is, especially when it comes to slavery and African Americans being a integral part of the state as well. It just gives us those visible cues that, yes, black people were here.
Well, let's talk about that word that you used, revisit our history, because we all think we have a pretty good idea of what New Hampshire was like in the colonial era and the revolutionary era, and hurrah, we went and beat the British and so forth. Talk a little bit more about that, Jerrianne. Revisit what we think we know.
The story of New England really is doesn't include slavery. When we think of slavery, we think of slavery as a Southern institution. And I think just imagining and seeing the burial ground, we know that not to be true. I was at an event the other day where the burial ground received an award, and the memorial received an award. And I was asked, so really, were the people buried there just collateral damage from the move to Canada? You know, they were just going through, you know, meaning the Underground Railroad, not a part of New Hampshire, that they didn't belong, that they weren't integral to our state, but they on their way to Canada to escape slavery, you know, they died in Portsmouth.
So people didn't understand that they lived with families here, that they were enslaved to white families in the seacoast and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, your collaborator on this, Valerie Cunningham, also talks about this in the film. Let's hear a little bit from Valerie now on the tendency of a lot of people to contrast slavery in the North with the South, kind of what you said, Jerianne. Well, you know, it wasn't as bad here as it was down there. Let's hear Valerie.
Because the numbers were larger, the stories are larger, everything is seen so much bigger and worse there than here. There is no comparison. When you're talking about the enslavement of human beings, you're talking about slavery, whether it is in the South or in the North, whether it ended then or now or later, it's still slavery.
Again, that's longtime Black history activist Valerie Cunningham talking in the new documentary called Shadows Fall North. And David Waters, you have written a lot about New Hampshire and New England history. What do you think about what Jerianne and Valerie say?
Well, I think we have to look so much at how we need to transform our history and understanding of the meaning of New Hampshire, that we can't understand freedom and the fight for freedom without seeing it as an African-American fight for freedom at a time when there's both freedom and slavery. Slavery was, without it, I don't think you could have built Portsmouth. The economy of colonial New Hampshire, almost every elite family, particularly ministers, couldn't do their jobs unless they had slaves doing their jobs. And slavery was tough in this state. If you look at the pauper farm registers and see the kind of physical conditions African Americans were in, or the escaped slave advertisements from the 1760s, which mentioned, you know, toes missing because they were frozen off. These people didn't have shoes. I also think we have to reimagine New Hampshire not as a white place. Danzy Senna's novel set here was called Caucasia for a reason, because New Hampshire had imagined itself as a white place without a black history. That was false in the past. It is false now. And I hope the film really shows that shadow of forgetting is something that has to be opened up. The light has to shine to see the truth here.
It's interesting what you said, David. You couldn't have built Portsmouth without slave labor. We often hear that the South economically could not have existed without the work of so many enslaved people. But I've never heard somebody say that about Portsmouth before.
Well, who drove the ox carts? You know, the Langdon family farm that meant they could build that, the Sherburn family farm that meant they could build that great mansion down in Portsmouth. There was slave labor. There's a slave burying ground out in the Sherburn family farm out behind the Christ Church there. Or who was working on the ships? The black population of Portsmouth is around 4% in 1770. It's around 4% now. And I think that was true in other cities, like Rollinsford, New Hampshire. The Wentworth family had a large farm there that raised a lot of slaves that were then sold elsewhere. Or Exeter, New Hampshire, a large slave population. So wherever you look, you find that this is the story of who opened up the land. Canterbury, New Hampshire. Who was clearing the land there? Who was felling the trees? Who was building the meeting house? It was slave labor.
Well, and I'm going to turn to you too, Nancy. You know, I have to say, just personally, I have been doing this show for more than 20 years. I know New Hampshire pretty well, and there's a lot in here, Nancy, that I did not know. What sort of jumped out at you as you were working on this film?
Well, I think everything jumped out at me. I think, having lived in New Hampshire too for about 25 years, and I actually grew up in the South. I went to the University of Georgia, so I knew about the Southern black culture. I knew about that history. And I remember in Newbury Elementary getting in trouble because I raised my hand when we were talking about slavery, and I said, well, wait a minute, wasn't it the clipper ships that went and brought the slaves over? And I was belligerent because we didn't want to talk about that. We don't want to admit that we had a hand in slavery, in segregation, in racism, and it continues through today. I mean, the comments I've gotten while out there when people say, well, what is Atlantic Media Productions working on now? And I say, well, we're doing a documentary on black history in New Hampshire, and probably 10 out of 10 people would laugh and say, what black history? And I would always follow it up with, exactly, this is why we're doing it. And I think we had our premiere at the Music Hall on May 26th, and we had 700 people there come to their feet at the end. And I think it was because we were thanking Valerie and Jerianne and David for the work that they have done in, you know, I uncovering this history. And we use the African burying ground in Portsmouth as a metaphor. And we want to keep asking the question, Laura, why don't you know about this history? Why aren't we teaching our kids about this history? And why does it literally continually be paved over and forgotten all the time? And so we're hoping that we can highlight the work that these amazing women, and David has done a lot of work on this too. We can bring it into the schools. We can bring it into fourth grade. We can bring it into the middle school. So it's not such a surprise anymore. And I think it's time that we have a big discussion about why we buried the history, why we don't talk about it. And I think it has a lot to do with the tension that we still experience today.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions, comments about this new film. Even if you haven't seen it, you might be familiar with some of the stories in it. It's called Shadows Fall North. It aims to reveal some of the little-known stories of African Americans in the Granite State and their importance to the state's overall past and present. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Jerianne, since you mentioned it and then Nancy just mentioned it, this idea of the African burying grounds in Portsmouth as a metaphor for this whole broader idea of a hidden history right beneath our feet, let's just remind people what the African burying grounds are, because I think a lot of people don't know what that is.
In 2003, during some construction work on Chestnut Street in Portsmouth, the grave sites of what the city had known in from older records as labeled as the Negro burying ground were disturbed. And that brought to the people's consciousness the story that, yes, they were actual Africans, African Americans, black people buried there in the street, even though there was a sign up acknowledging the space as the African burying
like
ground.
Like a historical
marker. A historical
marker
that the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail has had up as one of its first markers. So, but this was the visible, factual confirmation that the town needed to say that this was indeed a burying ground.
Coffins and bones.
Coffins and bones. So the actual seeing of that made the acknowledgement easier.
To say it was right
to
here.
To say it was there.
Yeah.
So the town then the mayor of Portsmouth then formed a Blue Ribbon Committee to figure out how to best honor the space. And that group, led by Vernice Jackson, and several meetings with the community, came up with what we know now as the memorial site. And so it's concrete, it's visible, and there are words stating that. So we can't say we don't know anymore.
We know that this is where it was. And the city, David, right, correct me if I'm wrong, the city, you know, made a big deal out of this. I mean, they took those coffins that had been disturbed, right, and gave them a proper placement elsewhere.
Well, it was an extraordinary process. I was there on one of the days when we carried two of the coffins out with Kel Edwards and Valerie were there, carried them out into a hearse with full prayers and ceremony, and they were taken for for examination by archaeologists and determined by looking at some of the sharpened teeth and some of the characteristics of a disease would indicate that these indeed were Africans buried there. So that was confirmed, and they were kept safely in storage while this process went forward. And Vernice Jackson, Jerry Ann, Valerie, and so many others in the community of memory, as I would like to call them, and worked with the city to say this history can never be buried again. And it's an extraordinary monument. And to me, what I think is so meaningful is the words of the slave petition running down the street that says, "The name of slaves shall be heard no more." And I think that those signers of that petition, who were, as they said, natives of Africa born free in 1779, a petition for their freedom, had a theory of memory themselves. They said, "We want to be remembered for who we were. We were born free natives of Africa." And they also had a theory of slavery. It is something that is created socially, the name of slavery. We refuse that name. We were human beings. And I think the memorial, now Portsmouth, coming together as a community, acknowledges that deep humanity. And I think it's something that can be that people can move forward on to embrace a more diverse New Hampshire.
Well, once this was all resolved, there was a, as you said, a service held, and it was made formalized. Let's hear a little bit from that service. Here's Arthur Hilson. He's preacher at New Hope Baptist Church in Portsmouth, at a service for the people who were finally found so many years later.
We pride ourselves in New England with historic cemeteries. We put out guides for tourists to come and see our historic cemeteries, never saying that beneath the pavement we trod upon, there's a people buried in a ground just as sacred as the other cemetery.
Again, that's preacher Arthur Hilson at New Hope Baptist Church. And Nancy, I'd love your thoughts too on just how this whole thing was resolved by the city of Portsmouth. It was difficult.
Well, I think that it took a decade, and the community sort of not taking no for an answer, and honestly, the city really embracing it, and then it was just figuring out how to move forward, and then raising money, finding the right person to build this memorial. And I would urge everybody listening, if you have not been to the African Burying Ground in Portsmouth, it's worth a trip wherever you are in the state or Maine or Massachusetts. It's between Court and State Street. It's absolutely beautiful. And when you sit there, I think you feel the spirits, and I think that I'm proud to. I live in Portsmouth, so I'm very proud of my city for coming together and actually making this happen. It's quite an important step forward.
Again, that's Nancy Vodder, film producer for Shadows Fall North, a new documentary about African American history in New Hampshire. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in now with our June Fund Drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Shadows Fall North, a new documentary explores New Hampshire's black history and uncovers stories that add to the narrative of who we are collectively as Granite Staters and what our shared history is. We want you to call in 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. With me in studio, two people who were very much involved in this film. Jerry Ann Bogus is here, director of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail, founder and director of the Harriet Wilson Project. Also, David Waters, state senator, English professor at UNH, and longtime New England historian. One more time, that exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And David and Jerry Ann, let's go to our listeners. Tracy joins us from Peterborough. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Go
ahead. Yes, go ahead. Did you want to add to our conversation? Okay. I wonder if he's having a hard time hearing us. Tracy, you there? All right. Well, hopefully he calls back. 1-800-892-6477. Again, is the number for you or Tracy to call us. 1-800-892-6477. Both of you, while we're getting some more listeners with us, I did want to ask you first, Jerry Ann, lots of stories in this film. Is there one story that you think is the most important for people to know? If you could just pick one, and I know that's hard.
Well, if I would just pick one, of course, I'd pick the one I worked on, Harriet Wilson Project, the story of Harriet Wilson, the first black female novelist in the country, in the world. She was actually born and grew up in Milford, New Hampshire. Who knew, right? And I think her story, along with the 1779 petition, they changed the stereotypes of what we think black people are, Africans are. We have these two literary pieces that speaks to not only their ability to write, but the intelligence of the piece. You know, that's always been a stereotype about blacks being uneducated, you know, and, you know, a feeble mind, in quotes. And so those two pieces of literature has to smash that stereotype to bits.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about the 1779 petition, because you mentioned it earlier, David. But let's talk about Harriet Wilson a little bit more. Some people know this story, but you're right, Jerrianne, a lot of people don't. Just remind us who she was. I mean, it's an amazing story.
So in 1859, Harriet Wilson published a book, Our Negro: Sketches in the Life of a Free Black, a long title, showing that slavery shadows fall even here. And in that book, she it's partly autobiographical, partly a novel. But she talks about her life in Milford to the family, in quotes in her book, was Mrs. B., which later we found out to be a real family, the Haywards in Milford. And she talks about her treatment in that family as being likened to that of a slave in the South. And she really, it's a very satirical novel that kind of smashes all the institutions of the day. You know, she writes about the hypocrisy of the North. You know, that, yeah, we indeed had slaves here. She writes about the hypocrisy of the church, you know, where there was racism in the church, the abolitionist movement, about motherhood. It just smashes all those sacred institutions. But for Wilson herself, not only did she publish this novel, but she was an entrepreneur in that she had a business, you know, a hair dyeing business. And then she... later on, we discovered that she also had a school in Boston, and she was a spiritualist leader and just so much more than what we had thought.
And she grew up from, I mean, terrible circumstances.
Why? Well, it antagonized the very people.
Sorry about that. She grew up in terrible circumstances. She was dropped off basically at age six by her mother, who couldn't keep her at this home of this white family, and basically had to work incredibly hard for this family.
So not unlike young boys and girls who were enslaved, Wilson also was, in all sense and purposes, enslaved to this family from the age of six until she reached her majority at age 18.
And then she left
and
started doing all these other...
Other businesses.
Yeah.
As a tool for survival, you know. There were not much opportunities for black people other than, you know, working in the fields or working in the house or their craft, you know, where blacks were pretty much worn out of town, you know, so that they wouldn't stay around and populate the country so we could keep the image of a majority white state. But so, you know, by necessity, she invented and reinvented herself time and time again for survival.
Well, here's a passage from Harriet Wilson's book, Our Nig. And at this point in the story, Harriet Wilson has just arrived at the house of this white family in Milford, New Hampshire. As I said, she's only 6 years old. So picture a six-year-old doing this. Here's a passage read by Stacey Thomas. And I just want to tell people that this passage from this piece of a historical novel has a word in it that a lot of people today find offensive. So here it is.
Where could she sleep? Asked Mary. I don't want her near me. In the L chamber, answered the mother. How she'll get there? Asked Jack. She'll be afraid to go through that dark passage, and she can't climb the ladder safely. She'll have to go there. It's good enough for a nigger, was the reply.
Again, that's a passage from Harriet Wilson's Our Nig. David Waters, I'd love your thoughts, too, on Harriet Wilson and just what a big deal it is to have this woman from New Hampshire, first African-American female novelist ever in this country.
And what a wonderful story. And that quote, I think, illuminates the issue about this book, that the book, like Harriet Wilson, has been stuffed up in the attic and tried to hide it away. She says in this title page, it's a two-story White House North, showing that slavery's shadow falls even there. Surely she's talking about the White House in Washington, that there's two stories. It's a symbol of freedom, but it's also a symbol of oppression. And what's more New England and New Hampshire than a White House? And yet stuffed in that White House, here is this young girl being treated like a slave. And Harriet Wilson, she is rebellious. She will not accept the roles of subservience that are put on her. She's supposed to be pious. She's supposed to be pure. She's supposed to be domestic. She's supposed to be submissive. And she rebels against all that because that's entrapment. That's the kind of enslavement that white womanhood, Mrs. Belmont, has created in that household. And so I think it's just such a rebellious piece of literature, and it speaks to much today. I mean, this is a black life that matters. It matters now, and it didn't matter then. And I think that's the message to the future for Harriet Wilson. The last page when she says that I'm going to pursue beyond the grave the memory of these people who treated me this way. This story has to live.
Well, and speaking of the story living, for a long time it was forgotten, David, right? Until it was discovered in the 1980s.
In 1982, Professor Henry Louis Gates, who Jerry Ann had to Milford to talk about the importance of this novel when the statue was unveiled. And, you know, he rediscovered this at a time when a lot of literature was being rediscovered. 1859, people didn't want to hear this kind of story. They didn't want to hear that the North treated people this way. But there are a lot of so-called copperheads and Democrats in the state. This is being presented as children's literature as well. And the usual black child in these books was good and pious, and all the good little white girls and their mothers who appreciated the darky in their midst were supposed to love her. And Harriet Wilson wouldn't truck with that.
Well, and in the film Shadows Fall North, UNH professor Jeff Bolster also talks about this, that the book Our Nig barely sold when it was first released.
Why? Well, in part, it antagonized the very people that might have bought it. It antagonized northern white abolitionists. It antagonized smug northern white church people. That's precisely the audience that might have bought the book. So Our Nig did not affect culture or society in its day.
One more question for you, Jerry Ann, because, again, this has been a huge project for you, getting Harriet Wilson recognized. You were the force that got a statue of Harriet Wilson put on a beautiful town green in Milford. You tried to get Our Nig put in the public school curriculum. What happened?
Well, there was some pushback on getting Wilson's book, and I don't think it's still in Milford School. Different teachers may teach it if they want to, but it's not required reading. But the thinking was that there really wasn't time for Wilson's book to be in there. In fact, you know, I was told, well, who are we going to take out so we can put Wilson's book in? And this one teacher had objected to it because of the language, you know, the title of the book, how exactly do we talk about it? And its subject matter, you know, slavery. And, of course, slavery didn't happen in New Hampshire, so teaching it. But more than that, I think it's just that our teachers don't know how to teach the book. They don't know how to talk about slavery. We don't know how to talk about racism. We don't know how to, when, you know, there is her title, Our Nig, scares our teachers. You know, how do we do this? And they would say, well, what happens when we have our one black student in the class? How do we address that? But it is, I think our country is at a point where we really need to look at our history of slavery and what it meant, what it means meant then and what it means now. I was watching another film the other day, The New Roots, and it's at the end they said it really is time for us to look at this history. We've never been able to mourn slavery, and we've never been able to heal from it. So in coming up with the language that we use to teach about it, you know, Wilson's book offered that opportunity to as a tool, a learning tool, a teaching tool about our story. But we have to be willing to embrace it and to get dirty. It's a dirty history. We have to be willing to say the wrong words and learn how to correct them. We have to be willing to get really deep and dirty in this. It's not a pretty history. There's no way to make it pretty. So we might as well face that and look at the ugliness and see how we heal from that.
Well, and you mentioned this earlier, David, but the history that a lot of us have of New England, especially early New England, is pretty. It's quite pretty.
Well, that's just it. We do have some good new resources now. Black Portsmouth that Valerie Cunningham and Mark Sammons published has so many stories in it. There is the Harriet Wilson story, which people can read. There's good research that's been done in historical New Hampshire. So it's now available. It's now there. But I think it's more of this kind of more thoroughgoing transformation of what do we need to know today. It's not just because the past is interesting, but that two-story White House, what voices do we have to hear right now so that we can understand how the past bears upon people living today?
Well, again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And in just a moment, I've got an email I want to share with you, a couple calls. And there's a lot more stories in this film that we haven't even talked about yet, including how a very fancy Grand Hotel was desegregated. There's a story about a school up in Canaan that I had not heard of until I watched this film. So a lot more in just a moment, but let's check in first with our June Fun Drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Shadows Fall North. That's a new documentary on New Hampshire's Black history. There are lots of stories in here that many of us might not be familiar with. Let's get your questions and comments in now at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jerrianne Bogus is here, director of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail, founder and director of the Harriet Wilson Project, along with Senator David Waters, English professor at UNH, longtime historian of New England. Both of them were involved with this film. And both of you, let's go to our listeners. And Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning. I'm calling you from the Nottingham Historical Society's headquarters, and I'm quoting from when we celebrated our 250th anniversary, we put on a newspaper, and the headline in the newspaper was Slaves of Nottingham. And I'm pointing out that, in fact, Nottingham, not only in Portsmouth, but towns in New Hampshire had slaves. That's what was so striking.
Steve, thank you for the call. Do you want to jump in, David Waters?
Yes, Steve. And, you know, up there on top of the hill in the parade ground areas in Nottingham, there is a slave burying ground up there. It's kind of overgrown, and but there's a stone wall around it, and there are several formerly, you know, enslaved people who were buried there. And this really is the story of rural New Hampshire, that wave of towns that got founded in the 18th century. But they usually are unknown. I mean, Canterbury, New Hampshire, Samson Battis, who I did a lot of research on, is born about 1750, lived to 1852. He and his wife had a dozen children. One of his daughters had 22 children. There were never more than three African Americans on the census report in Canterbury. I mean, Canterbury had what they called a guinea town, or there's Coffee Town Road in Deerfield. So these
That's what they called it, Coffee Town?
Yeah, for Cuffy, the Friday day name from West Africa, Cuffy, Coffee Town. And so in the 19th century, people knew about this, but there was a process of forgetting. Once slavery became illegal, the new ideology of inferiority, racial inferiority for black people. And so this became a process of exclusion and a kind of erasure from memory. And you can see it in the town histories. They're in there. The blacks are in the town histories of the 1840s and 50s. By the 1890s, when you have the corrosive effects of the failure of integration, that's when, during that period, 1890, 1920, black history, black people are forced out of northern New England.
Wow. So once slavery was illegal, things changed, but not necessarily in the way that you would think, David.
Well, a new ideology, Joanne Pope Militia in her book Disowning Slavery talks about the very careful process of kind of racialization of black people in a inferiority. Also here is the fear of the black male body, the fear of miscegenation, that was the Southern principle that came north, that even if there is technical freedom here, we don't want social mixing because it means black men and white women. And that was the cause of a lot of anxiety and a lot of racial violence in the North.
Well, and after the Civil War, after slavery was ended, as you said, David, it didn't mean things were, you know, sunshine and light. Here's Valerie Cunningham in the film saying that even though blacks in New Hampshire were free, after the Civil War, there wasn't really a place for them here, especially in the economy. Let's hear.
If you were hiring somebody, you would hire a white person. So most of the black people who were still living here were older people who perhaps would not be so inclined to move and start life anew someplace else, and they were self-employed. And there was no motivation for younger people to stay here. They would leave. They would go to some place where they could find work and where they could find a more vibrant social life. Not unlike today.
Again, that's Valerie Cunningham in the film Shadows Fall North. I love your thoughts, too, on that, Jerrianne Bogus, that it's, you know, that New England wasn't seen as a welcoming place for black people.
Well, I just pick up on one of the big things where what the fear was that David mentioned, this fear of the race mixing. It was one of the things that brought down Noyes Academy, the great experiment of bringing together and educating black men, women, along with white people in the population. The Noyes Academy was a school up in Canaan that did that in the 1800s. And the town really, and not only the town of Canaan, but surrounding towns really band together and tore the school off its foundation. So it was that fear of, again, the black body, what that means if you have more than one people moving in and you're mixing. It's more than the fear of integration. It's the fear of the erasure of whiteness, I think, you know, that scares the majority culture. And we see that even today when it's the same fear that runs through when we look at a population that's browning, you know. So in order to not have that fear become a truism, the racism has to stay dominant in our culture, you know. And so we see white supremacy, you know.
Let's take another call. Another person wants to jump in. And Pat is joining us from Sanford, Maine. Hi, Pat. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling about in my eighth great grandfather's will, he had left his slave, his manservant, Caesar, to his wife. And when she died, he was to go to his children. Was that to protect his slave so that he wouldn't be out there on his own? Because he also had Indian slaves, but he set them free.
That's really interesting. So he did not free his African-American slave, manservant, but did free his Native American slaves.
Right from Africa, I guess. He was originally, he was selling his people, and then he got caught, and my eighth grandfather ended up with him. But he was his manservant, so I figure he, you know.
Well, Pat, thank you for the call. Yeah. Does this sound typical, David?
Well, actually, it does. You know, this is a valuable piece of property. And that's how this man, Caesar, would have been considered, as a piece of property who had great value to this family and be given as a legacy down to the generation, perhaps, if Caesar had descendants, be born into slavery as well. There was Indian slavery in New England, but for kind of diplomatic reasons with the tribes, and also because of, you know, racial theory developing in the 1700s, there were solely laws passed against Native American slavery in New England. However, Native Americans captured after King Philip's War, for example, about 80 or 90 in Dover, New Hampshire, in 1678, were actually sold into slavery down into Nevis, into Bermuda, into St. Kitts, and so that and the Pequots before them in 1630s. Hundreds and hundreds have been sold into slavery. They didn't want to keep them local, because they might be too dangerous and have a tribe to which they could return if they escaped, so they'd be sold into slavery down into the Caribbean or even into the Mediterranean. There's some letters of some Native Americans in the 1670s and 80s wanting to get home from having been sold into slavery in the north coast of Africa.
Wow.
So complex and stories. And,
yeah.
And these families, these are in, you know, this is the thing. These families know these stories, but we have to make them public again.
Well, Pat, thank you again for the call. And getting back real quickly to the story that you were telling, Jerry-Ann, about the Noyes School. Is that how you say
Noyes
it?
Academy.
Noyes Academy in Canaan. This is a story that I had never heard, even with my many years of looking at New Hampshire. And as you said, this was a boarding school started by an abolitionist who wanted to, you know, he recruited students, boys and girls, to come to Canaan, northern New Hampshire, and start this school. And the local people did not love this idea. And I want to play a statement that was published in the New Hampshire Patriot and State Gazette. This is read by Dennis Collins Johnson. And again, this is from the film Shadows Fall North. Let's hear.
It is said that one of the principal agitators of the slave question in this state, George Kimball Esquire and his family, sit at a table with a half dozen colored people, while a white girl attends upon them as servant. We do not wonder that the white people of Canaan should consider such an establishment a nuisance, and that they should adopt all lawful measures for its removal.
And again, that's a clip from the movie Shadows Fall North about New Hampshire's Black history, just showing how upset people were about the idea of this David Waters interracial school.
It's a perfect quote. See, this is inverting the natural order of white people and white women over black people. And what an irony that here education in New Hampshire is supposed to be that beacon of freedom and equal opportunity, and yet on July 4th, teams of oxen line up, a cannon is fired to smash all the windows of that academy, is dragged off its foundations into a swamp. And I think it really still begs the question of how much equal opportunity do we have in education in New Hampshire today. You know, segregation continued in Portsmouth into the 1960s. Elizabeth Virgil, first black graduate of UNH, had to go south to get work. Today, with the cost of education, can people of color really take advantage of what is offered here? So I think that story, while a bizarre story from the past, really indicates whether we're living up to our ideals in terms of education today.
Well, both of you, there's so much more we could talk about. I have to wrap it up here. I want to thank you both very much for coming in and talking about this new documentary, Shadows Fall North. Jerry-Ann Bogus and David Waters, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you, Laura.
Us, Laura.
Many stories to tell.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in very quickly with our June fund drive.